I thank Don Lipsett, members of the Philadelphia Society, for offering me the opportunity this evening to bring you up to date in as brief a way as I can, and yet hopefully informatively, on a project that I'm working on that I'm sure you're going to be very excited and interested in. Obviously, your warm welcome would not certainly have been echoed by my 153 colleagues who are on the other side of that issue of federal funding for public broadcasting. I can assure you we won't win. unless they change the balloting procedures. However, that's been known to happen, but I doubt if I can carry it off in this instance. A quick comment on that is it's a diversion. I am very fortunate to also have a board of directors that I have convinced over a period of years that I sometimes know the right way to go on things, no pun intended. In this instance, they have wholeheartedly supported that and done so understanding that means somewhere down the road we may have to pay the piper. I don't think it's all that difficult a problem. At this point in time, we're trying to be political realists, and we've simply said that federal funding, and incidentally, the federal funding of public broadcasting currently is provided for in a three-year appropriation, which carries us through to 1980. And Carter's proposal, which you may have seen for 5 years, is for the next 5 years after that. We've simply suggested a very modest change, which is that taking the 1980 level, which is already set by Congress, that it from that point on is simply be indexed to inflation and no further increases provided. Hopefully that under that circumstance, there would be generated some enthusiasm for finding other ways to fund public broadcasting, and over a period of time then we could suggest, well, why not reduce it? I don't know if our tactic will succeed, but we're certainly going to try. I want to be as brief as I can, but I also don't want to simply show you the program without giving you a reasonable context within which to see it. First of all, Don Lipsett has to be charged with breaking the truth in advertising requirements and regulations, in that what you're going to see this evening are not segments from the proposed television series themselves. We began shooting those in San Francisco on March 13. And although I might be successful in having things happen fairly rapidly, that's far beyond my capability. In fact, Dr. Friedman and I, along with Rose, will be traveling to London in the next 10 days to see the first rough edit of the material that we have been shooting over the past 2.5 weeks. And that material is for the initial program in a series, for one program in a series of 10, which we expect to have on the public broadcasting service beginning in September of 1979. Now that also may cause you some of the concern as it does us. However, these things do not happen easily. And we are much more concerned that in this case, we do not repeat the lack of success of John Kenneth Galbraith in his effort. I think that in a way you owe John Kenneth a round of applause, because had Milton Friedman had the Milton Friedman series, and incidentally we don't have a title for it yet, but I'll tell you my favorite, and there are several others. My favorite is the title would be Economics of Freedom, but we're working and we're not sure that's it, and we've kicked around a lot of things. But had a program of that type been offered to PBS 2 or 3 years ago, I wouldn't say categorically that it would not have been carried by the network, but I think it would have been very difficult to get it on. And I think, too, had it been carried, there would have been a very few stations who would have actually broadcast it. John Kenneth has changed all that. He came first, he got on, and there were some 230-some stations out of 266 carried it. And any of you who know the Fairness Doctrine and know how to call your public television station at the right time will ensure that at least 230-some stations carry the Friedman series. And that, incidentally, is something that cannot be said for most programs that go on the system, that you have absolutely no guarantee how many stations will carry it. So it's a very unique situation, and I think a beneficial one, to have that kind of a lever to get a maximum number of stations to carry, and second, to have seen the opposition first. It's helpful to have that advantage. Don mentioned Alan Wallace, and I want since I will not be here tomorrow, and since I would guess I have not seen Alan, I assume he's not arriving until tomorrow, to make it very clear to all of you that Alan Wallace has a very significant role in this project. Not in terms of time and energy, but in terms of a very key and important step. And that was that a year ago, this past October, October of 1976, and in fact, as until January 5th of 1977, I did not know Dr. Milton Friedman. On that day, through the good offices of Alan Wallace, I met with Dr. Friedman for the first time in San Francisco. And were it not for Alan Wallace's support and encouragement, and most importantly, his vital introduction, I would suggest that you would not be hearing of a Milton Friedman series at this point in time. Because, again, I know of only one other person in the system who, in my judgment, would have approached Dr. Friedman with an offer which would have interested him. And I don't say that because I'm, unusually creative as compared to my colleagues, but because I had a reasonable ideological sympathy with Dr. Friedman and was able to assure him that his positions would be presented as he wished them, and at the highest level of integrity. And I think that we will achieve that objective. And if the young man who is the producer of the series, Michael Latham, who was until he worked on this project with the BBC, if he meets the level of standard that he's established for himself as what I would call a world-class producer, we will also have an extremely entertaining and exciting series that will not only appeal to you, but to be very honest, I really don't care whether it appeals to you or not. I care whether it appeals to the truck driver when he gets home at night and sits and drinks that beer. And incidentally, the demographics of those who watched the Galbraith series were such that 51% of the audience, to the extent that you can trust the surveys, had incomes less than $15,000 a year, and did not have even a high school education. So to suggest that you cannot reach that audience with this type of program, I think is not true. We are undertaking a massive and intensive publicity campaign, and each one of you can be extremely helpful in that. And I will now put Don Lipset really on the spot by volunteering the fact that through the Philadelphia Society and working with Don and others, we will make sure that you are kept informed of the progress of this project, and that each of you in your own ways, in your own communities, can act as PR representatives. But that's, we have a very, very aggressive plan. We expect this series to have the largest audience of any series that was ever on public television, and I think that I think we have the wherewithal to achieve that objective. I want to quickly pay comments or compliments to a few other individuals and agencies. I think it's important that you understand and have in mind at least four company foundations. To date, the budget for the projects is just a little less than $3 million. And to date, I've managed to put together $2.1 million of that. I feel a little difficulty in putting together the balance. However, I can assure you it was not easy, and that although I would have to say that Donald Kendall and PepsiCo are supporting the Friedman Project, there are a number of others of corporate America who are not, and some of whom were rather outspoken in their indications as to why they would not. National Presto Company in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, however, stepped to the line, and Mel Cohen there provided the first funding, $50,000. Not a lot of money, but it said, hey, somebody out there felt that this was important enough to put something on the line. The next key and very important support was provided by the John M. Olin Foundation. Frank O'Connell's here, and he's participating tomorrow in your program. Frank has been instrumental not only in getting that support, but also in assisting in urging others along the way. The next thing I needed beyond the John M. Olin support was a really major kind of top of the line grant, and that came from Dick Larry and the Scaife Foundation, $500,000. I'm giving you a little kind of a historical thing too. The next problem I had, however, was if you keep in mind those three, although National Presto was the source, it was a foundation that gave the money there. So I had three foundations, and now I was very, very much in trouble, because if I did not get a break in corporate America, the program was going to fail. And the next key grant came from Getty Oil, and that was the one that kind of tilted it. And there have been many since, and I won't go further, but to give you some idea of those agencies and that stepped to the line to make this happen. And there are also a very large number of individuals and smaller companies that provided me with some planning money to help pay for the fact that I was running all over the United States, and to convince my board of directors that they should be happy with the fact that we had a senior vice president at home running the shop while I was doing all these, what could have been looked upon as rather extravagant, ridiculous projects. And one of those individuals is here, and I simply thank him personally. You give me the form to do so, Harold Ransberg, or Ransberg Corporation. And there were many others who made small grants to help. Quick comment on the program, and then we'll show you a little bit of what we have. The series is intended to make the strongest possible case for the relationship between political and personal freedom and economic freedom. And I don't have to tell you that Milton Friedman is one of the people most eminently qualified in the United States to make that case. We are trying very hard with some very sensitive production people to assist him in doing that. What you're going to see tonight are segments from a question and answer session at two of a total of what will be 15 lectures that Dr. Friedman has given, and he still has three remaining to give throughout the United States. And that was a part of a deal. When I went to see Milton, I went in with the idea that Milton Friedman could do a good Bronowski-type series, The Ascent of Man. And Milton said to me, oh, Bob, that's not where I'm strong. I'm strong on this give-and-take, question-and-answer kind of thing, like at the Phil Donahue show. And I said, that's fine for the Phil Donahue show, Milton, and that is effective. But I said, we want to do a program, hopefully, that's going to be used in colleges and universities and be in the video cassette rooms of corporations for 5-10 years, and one that addresses basic principle, not day-to-day issues. Now, that's not denying the value of addressing day-to-day issues, but the need for a basic collection of the principles of the free market. Well, he agreed with that, and so we struggled with how could we combine the two things. Well, I went away after my first meeting and saw Milton about 4 days later, and through some suggestions from some staff members continued to sit in the room and stare at the wall efforts on my part, came back to Milton with the suggestion that he do a series of lectures and that we do two things, that we use those lectures as a basis for developing the, arriving at the content base of the series from which scripts could be developed and very highly visual and exciting material produced. And that we would also then extract segments from the lectures, which we would use and intercut with documentary footage to make the series. And that was essentially our initial idea. And you're going to see the results of that. We went ahead and did the TV series about, or the TV lectures and televised them, about a month ago. And I'm trying to think. I think it was at the University of Rochester that we went back, we were doing one of these lectures, and Milton finally came up to me and he said, Bob, he says, you really conned me on this one, didn't you? I said, what do you mean? He said, oh, you know what I mean. He said, and the reason, at that point, by that point in time, it had become obvious to Milton, as it was to us earlier, that none of the material from the lectures would really work in terms of intercutting it with the final television project. So, as Milton said, he said, we've really got two projects going here. I'm doing these TV lectures, and then you got me shooting this series of films. Let me assure you that that is true. It has evolved that way. And I can tell you that Dr. Milton Friedman is totally committed to this project. He has essentially taken this on as essentially his effort at accomplishing the kind of things that you are also committed to. I think it's going to work. I wanted to tell you a few brief things that have happened that suggest to me it's going to work, and then we'll look at the material. I'd love to tell you about all the cab drivers I've been talking to and some of the interesting things I've found. And I've found two that I have, that I've collected. I'm collecting cab drivers. One is a Greek immigrant in New York City who gave me a free ride to LaGuardia Airport in his off-duty cab on one of those afternoons when it was raining cats and dogs and with four suitcases and nobody picks you up. And on the way to the airport, I found out that he found that the United States still offered that opportunity. I think everyone in this room believes that it does. And that he couldn't make a living and survive in Greece, but that here it was there. And the second one was a cab driver in D.C. who was black. His grandfather was a slave, and who proceeded without any prompting on my part to lecture me on the reason why the United States was the greatest country in the world, and it was because of what he called this political and, how do you put it, this free enterprise thing, free politics, I think is the way he's put it, free politics. And he said, you know, and the small businessman is where it's at. And he said, people got to understand you have to be small before you can be big. And he went on to, you know, on a basic grassroots understanding of what it was all about. And I think that gives some indication that we may succeed. And we did some filming about 10 days ago in the Library of Congress. Now, I wasn't there, but the producer told me of this. And it was at the end of it's part of the program we're talking about consumerism. And Milton will illustrate by the 21 feet of the Federal Register that represents the regulations that exist, the mass increase in Federal regulation. Well, he's in the hall of the Library of Congress while they're filming. And the producer indicated to me that it was in a part of the Congress library where there is a second level and a balcony that goes around. And they were filming down in the bottom area, and they had a lot of lights set up. And Milton was doing his thing. And while they were doing the preliminary dress rehearsals, etc., a crowd gathered in this balcony. And the producer said it ended up being 150, 200 people. And they did the final take, and Milton went on in a very eloquent way about federal regulation and that it was one of the key difficulties we faced in this country and it ought to be reduced, etc., etc., etc. It was a very effective take, came to the end, cut, silence, a huge burst of applause. in the Library of Congress from all the people gathered in the balcony. Milton was humbled. And I think it was one of the best things that could have happened for this series, because it was at a key point in which Milton had begun to come to grips with my problems. And by that I mean, I have tried very, very hard, and I hope successfully, to have Milton begin to make, and I'm sorry to use that term after what was said earlier, to make the compromise that he was going to have to make between his academic background and his scholarly years of scholarly work and the demands of television, and try to get him to understand that his integrity could be maintained and at the same time address the needs of television. And he's doing that very effectively. And to have that kind of reinforcement at that point in time, not only of the ideas he was speaking of, but obviously of the effectiveness with which he stated them, it was very helpful to our project. Unfortunately, I can't show you that. I would love to show you that sequence, but it's in London right now being edited. I will show you some other things. I've got to give a plug for one other thing. And I hate to take so long, but this is very important, I think, to all of us. On July 9th, PBS will carry another series that I have managed to scrape together. The title of this one I've fought with the producer over it for months, and I've now said, this is what it's going to be, forget it. And the title is Economic Issue. It will be a weekly program hosted by Dr. Marina Whitman of the University of Pittsburgh. And it will each week guarantee on public television at least 10 minutes of the half hour will be advocacy for free market economics. The other 10 minutes will be advocacy for the other side, but you know how that works in television. And I think it's a reasonable price to pay, since the other side gets a pretty good shot anyway. It isn't going to hurt them to get another 10 minutes if that's what it costs to get ours. And included in the program will be a film segment each week that hopefully sets forth the problem in ways that clarify the issue. And I urge you to look at that and to be aware that it's coming. And again, through Don, I'll try to give you the specifics. Because again, these are openings. They are movements to bring into the mass media the kinds of things we would like to hear discussed openly. And your help in making sure the community knows about them, tunes them in and watches, and writes those cards and letters. You know, that's my business. Keep those cards and letters coming, and it will begin to happen. Let me run some material now for you, and understand these are question and answer sessions with Dr. Friedman that will provide some of the base for what we're doing. Thank you.
As you noted from your quote from Oliver Lippmann in the 1920s, this question of government intervention has been around for a long time. And while a lot of us certainly would say that there's more of it today, you could easily go back, say, to the 1890s and find the activities of state legislatures, protectionism, in the international field, local cartels that existed in profusion, and so on. And I was curious if you could kind of rigorously define why it is that you feel that it's a much greater threat today than it was there. Is it, quantitative government spending and the like, or is there some other aspect of it?
I think there are two features of it that make it a far more serious problem than it was in 1990. First is a greater extent. The second is a greater centralization. Now, government spending is not per se an ideal measure of the extent of government intervention. You can have a lot of government intervention with no spending. For example, the minimum wage law is a tremendous government intervention. But the budget of the minimum wage agency is not very large and doesn't really measure the importance of that intervention. And yet, as a crude measure, I think total spending is a pretty good measure. In the 1890s, total government spending in the United States was 10% of national income. Of that, two-thirds was state and local and one-third was federal. Federal spending is 3%. Now, 2/3 is, and state and local spending was about 6%. Today, two things, total spending at all levels is 40% of the national income, and 2/3 of that is federal. It's about 10 times as large as it was then. So that's one measure that you've moved into a different dimension, a different order of magnitude. A second important measure is just to consider the number of activities with which you are no longer free to move. You cannot, the number of areas which have been largely taken over and preempted by the government. You obviously, you cannot set up a bank without getting a certificate of convenience and necessity. You cannot become a physician, a lawyer, a beautician, a mortician, a dentician, you name any one of a thousand, out of a hundred. This varies from state to state. You've got to have a license. You can't run a taxi cab without getting a license from the city. There are an enormous number of activities in which you are now restricted where you weren't before. In the 1890s, the scope of government was much more narrowly restricted. There were some tariffs, of course. There were some local arguments. In fact, there may well have been more local interventions in government. But you see, again, I mentioned in the course of my talk about the importance of seeing how people vote with their feet. The crucial things about local measures is that they are things people can vote against with their feet. If you don't like what your community is doing, you can move to another one. But once this is done centrally from the central government, you can't. So I would say that the two things I would cite in answer to your question is most important are the growing fraction of our national income, the use of which is being mandated by the government, and the growing centralization of that activity. Yes, ma'am.
You said something like the past decade you've had a little more hope for change.
Yeah.
Well, how do you think people our age can help affect that change?
Well, there's only one way you can affect that change, and that, in my opinion, and that is by trying to form your own opinions and persuading your fellow citizens of your age and others of the same opinion. This is fundamentally a democracy. We have been moving in the direction we've been moving in, not because there have been some bad people or some evil conspiracy that has been moving us in that direction. We've been moving in that direction because the public at large has believed that's a desirable direction to move. Because the attitudes of the public in the course of the past 60, 70 years moved away from a belief in laissez-faire, a belief in individual responsibility, and toward a belief in collective responsibility, moved away from the idea that the role of government should be as an umpire to the idea the role of government should be to take care of people. Well, it's only as the public at large recognizes that that's a mistake and recognizes where it leads us that we're going to get a change. Now, moreover, it's only your generation that can lead. You know, it's a terrible thing to say, but it's true. It's bad. The hardest thing in the world is for people to change their opinions. Once people are past 30, they're almost hopeless. I agree with that slogan. I don't trust anybody over 30. Because it's really only when people are in your age, in their formative age, that they are forming their basic values and beliefs. And indeed, that's why I believe there's real hope, because I believe people of your age are coming to a different view and a different recognition. And I think the problem for the rest of us is to try to hold the tide back until your generation come along and really push it back.
In your opening comments, sir, you made some reference to ethnic separation and the melting pot. Well, it seemed that you spoke in disparaging tones as to ethnic solidarity. Could you please comment on that?
Sure, I'll be glad to. I believe it's highly desirable for people to be able to pursue their own values, to have whatever ethnic values they want, provided they do it voluntarily and do not interfere with the freedom of others to do it also. We want a society of variety and diversity. We want a society in which people can celebrate their own special ethnic background. But that's a very different thing from a society in which there is somehow, which somehow takes ethnic characteristics as a criterion for preference or lack of preference. for a society which moves away from the doctrine of colored blindness to the doctrine of so-called affirmative action. That's the problem. The problem is, you see, this is one component of a very much broader problem. You cannot achieve, in general, good ends by bad means. And the end, the desire to correct past discrimination, the desire to improve the conditions of people, is an equity, and to enable people of all colors, creeds, backgrounds, to have a more even start, is an admirable end. But that end is corrupted when you use the wrong methods to achieve it. And the methods of force and coercion are, in my opinion, the wrong methods that do corrupt. And quite often,
don't you think it's the left of solidarity that many minority groups are able to make advances in American society?
Not in the slightest. If you look at the way in which ethnic minorities made advances, it was not through ethnic solidarity. It was through the free market. You can take any group you want. Whether you take, for example, the group obviously I've been closest to are the Jews. How did the Jews make their money? But only in the competitive areas of the American economy. How did the blacks make their way? Only, primarily, in the competitive areas. The laws, what have been the greatest hindrance? Where are the areas where the blacks have been most hindered? In those areas where government is supposedly even doing something for them. There is no area in American life in which the blacks are more disadvantaged than the kind of schooling they can get. Why? Because it's provided by the government. The minimum wage laws are supposed to be to help the poor, to help the disadvantaged. They are the most anti-Negro laws of the books. Why do we have unemployment rates of 40 to 50 to 60% for black teenagers? Because the law says it is illegal for an employer to hire them at a wage which corresponds to their productivity and to their worth. And he can only hire them if he's going to find charity. It's a law that he must discriminate against people with low skills. First, we give them lousy government schools so they have no skills. And then we make it impossible for them to get job training on the job, by saying to employers it's illegal for you to hire them. And that's why, if you look at the record, you know this is a recent phenomenon. If you go back to the immediate post-war period, before the minimum wage was rising, the unemployment rate for black teenagers and white teenagers is roughly the same. Today, it's two or three times as high for black teenagers. If you go back to that period, the fraction of black teenagers in the labor force was higher than of white teenagers. Today it's lower. Why? That's almost entirely a result of the minimum wage law plus a very inferior form of governmental education. Again, what has been the source and the focus of racial discrimination? The craft trade union. Why? Because they have gotten governmental monopoly powers, essentially, that has enabled them to keep people in. What is the commercial activity, which has had the greatest degree of exclusiveness of blacks and, in this case, also of Jews? No doubt. For decades, it was banking. Why? Because banks had a franchise from the government. You will search long and hard before you find any minority that has effectively had its rights protected or its opportunities expanded by government intervention in its behalf. Try to find an example.
Isn't it often through solidarity of a group that they're able to fight government intervention, such as in, or any group's intervention in their rights, such as overthrowing quota systems?
Let me separate this. I have no quarrel to have some solidarity, of course, in the sense of helping one another, and no doubt, by feeling of identification and assisting one another, they have helped one another, of course. But the particular aspect you're taking is to say that one evil raises another evil. I agree with you that once you start on the risk, when you turn to government to control the conditions of energy, then people who want to fight against bad government discrimination have no other choice but to go through the same political mechanism. So I agree with you. But that's it. As a lesser evil, not as a positive good.
Thank you. Dr. Friedman, in relation to your statements as far as Mexican immigration goes,
that has been following the comment, and that is that it seems to me that Mexican immigrants have a choice between, on one hand, staying in Mexico and getting what life they can, which to me seems like trying to evade starvation as long as possible, or crossing the river and then taking the job available. And what I'm wondering is this choice a choice at all, and is it not equivalent to the gun against the head that you were talking about as absent from the brief?
Calling the gun.
The capitalists in Southern California allowing
on the contrary, it's in your image, it would be the Mexicans who are holding the gun.
Well,
because what denies them the opportunity in Mexico?
There are enough capitalists in Mexico, as opposed to...
You must distinguish sharp between the somebody giving you a choice, which is not a very satisfactory, and somebody imposing something on you. Nobody is holding a gun to the head of these people and saying they should come to California. They are coming there because they believe they can have a better life for themselves and their children.
They can't have a better one, yes, but is it a life? All right, as you said yourself, no American would like to do these jobs.
No, it's not that no American would like to. Many Americans would be perfectly willing to if that were their only alternative, but the Americans have better opportunities. Fine. How did the Americans get to have those opportunities?
By being American citizens, that was the point.
No, by initially going through stages similar to that which the Mexicans are going through.
So
people don't come full-blown into the world. The nations don't come full-blown into the world with skills and capital and so on. That all has to be derived through a long historical process.
Okay.
And what's the alternative? If you say, well, we're willing to have the Mexicans in only if they can be supported at the level at which the Americans are supported, then you're condemning them to stay in Mexico.
But it's
so don't hurt them in order to help them.
It's not true that the wine growers in Southern California would prefer to have these Mexicans working at the rate they are working at, than they would to have Americans come in and demand higher wages because of the alternatives they have.
They would prefer to pay lower wages rather than higher wages. You would like to pay lower prices for the things you buy rather than higher prices. Of course, that's the whole system. That's exactly the system. And if you say to the Mexicans, you may not offer to work for all of them, then you're denying them the only weapon they have.
But
that's why equal pay and equal work laws are a source of apartheid. You know, the basic source of apartheid in South Africa was the insistence by trade unions on equal pay for equal work. The women who go around today urging equal pay for equal work are being anti-feminist. They don't intend to be. But that is the effect of their policy. Because if there is any activity in which, for any reason, a male is preferable to a female, or vice versa, the only weapon the less productive sex has is to offer to work for less. And if you deny them that opportunity, you're assuring yourself that you're going to have all male jobs, or all female jobs, or all white jobs, or all black jobs.
But aren't you also condemning them to stay that way?
Not at all. Not at all. The typical course, if you go back to American history, by taking these low-paid jobs, a great many people, not all, but a great many people were able to develop skills and activities, accumulate a little skill, a little capital, a little knowledge, improve their lives, become advanced in the stage, get to a higher level of productivity, and get a higher income. That's been the typical way up the ladder for most of the people who came in. It was the way up the ladder for my parents, for your parents, or grandparents, or great-grandparents, I don't know when. And that's the way in which, unfortunately, there's no way in which you can immediately propel people to the top of the ladder.
Dr. Friedman, in the past several months, we've heard a lot of publicity about the size of our national trade deficit. And the primary concern seems to be the number of dollars flowing out versus the number flowing in. But it seems there's a complete disregard for the number of goods coming in versus the number of goods coming out. I'd like some of your opinions on this.
Well, I think that the so-called trade deficit is an utterly false issue. It used to be an important issue. When we had price fixing of the price of the dollar, we had fixed exchange rates, when the U.S. government was committed to providing gold to foreign countries for $35 an ounce. At that time, a trade deficit was a very serious matter because it put the government in a position where it had to do something.
But today, a trade deficit is of no significance at all. How can we create it? How is it? People say, well, now we're spending more money abroad, more dollars abroad, than people are buying American goods. How is that possible? What are the people who are getting the dollars abroad doing with? Are they bringing it up? If so, fine. The Japanese would be, they send us over television sets and automobiles and they can return these green pieces of paper. Gee, what fools we would be not to take up that deal. And of course, they wouldn't be fools enough to do it. So in fact, there is no deficit in that sense. What's happening is that all of this trade deficit comes from looking only at some transactions and not at others. If foreigners are acquiring more dollars from selling us goods, I'm sorry, yes, than they are spending on our goods, then they're using the remaining dollars either to buy services here, or to buy stocks, or to buy property, or to buy capital, or in some other way. They are not sitting on those dollar bills. They're not burning them up, you can be sure of that. So in my opinion, there is no problem that is less significant or less important in the so-called trade deficit, provided we allow the exchange rate of the dollar vis-a-vis other currencies to be determined in the free market and be whatever it may be. If people abroad decide that they are acquiring more dollars than they really want, well, then that's very easy. Then they will try to get rid of them. How can they get rid of them? Only by, let's take the case that people are most worried about, the Japanese. Well, the Japanese are acquiring dollars, and what they want is yen. So they will offer more dollars to yen. That means the price of the yen in terms of dollars goes up. That means Japanese goods become more expensive to Americans. American goods become less expensive to Japanese. That means we'll buy less from them, and they'll buy more from us. So there's an automatic process in there that will adjust the trend. And over any considerable period of time, we're going to sell as many goods abroad as people are going to buy here, and you don't have to worry about that. Yes, sir.
It seems to me that the United States has been getting gradually more socialistic. Would you agree with that statement? As time has been going on in the last two or three decades?
Yeah.
And it also, from what I've been reading, there are certain organizations, such as the Council of Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, organizations that most people are not aware of. And I was wondering if, in your travels to Washington and dealing with top economists and so on, if you could tell us a little bit about the purposes of those organizations. And
I believe that, you know, there's a lot of people sort of have an idea that if something bad is happening, it must be because some evil people are trying to do it. You know, people are always looking for a devil. And some people have been trying to find the devil in the Council of Foreign Relations or in the Trilateral Commission, or in the international bankers, or in some other group of evil people who are planning it all this way. Frankly, I think that's a bunch of other nonsense to begin with. If you want to find the devil who is responsible for our becoming more selfish, go home and look in the mirror. We are all of us responsible. We really do have ultimately the mind. If Washington has been making us more social, by going in for more and more programs, spending more and more money, imposing more and more taxes on us, it's because we as citizens have been asking Washington to do it. Everybody says, well, of course, I don't like people spending money, but my program, that's different. I want them to spend it on me. And so far as the Council on Foreign Relations is concerned, it's an organization of well-meaning people. I happen to disagree with many of their views. I agree with others. But it's an organization of well-meaning people in New York and around the country, who hold meetings, who publish a journal, who have discussion groups and so on. They have been very much concerned, particularly with foreign policy. They undoubtedly encompass many of the leading figures in this country who have been concerned with foreign policy. But there is nothing, there is no secret underlying conspiracy that is going on. You just find out a wrong track in that way.
I didn't finish the question. I didn't mean to imply that there was any conspiracy or that there was any evil intention on the part of these organizations. It's not necessarily evil to believe in a political philosophy such as socialism. A lot of countries do. But is that not their position? Have they not staffed the government with a lot of their members who subscribe to this, such as Dr. Kissinger, who was a member of the CFR.
No, I don't believe I have. I believe that most people who are interested most people who are very much interested in foreign affairs will be associated with Council on Foreign Relations or with some other foreign affairs organization. And those positions in government are likely to be filled with people who have had interest in it. But those people have not had as a major in foreign relations area, certainly socialism has not been their major objective at all. That hasn't been what has driven them. It's a very different set of principles that have driven them. The move towards socialism has been fundamentally sparked by the intellectual community. It's been sparked in this country, and I believe in many countries, by a fundamental change over the past 40 or 50 years in Soviet basic philosophy. The fundamental philosophy used to be a philosophy of individual responsibility. If people were responsible for themselves, that it was up to them to use their resources as effectively as they could, that they would be blamed if they failed, they would be rewarded if they succeeded, if they inflicted harm on somebody else, they would be held responsible. Increasingly, we have had a shift toward a doctrine of social responsibility, that people are not really responsible for themselves, but somehow or other society in the abstract is responsible. That somehow or other, if I don't succeed, it's because people have been denying me opportunity or somehow having to provide a committee. And I believe it's this shift from individual responsibility to social responsibility that has led to a belief, to a concept of using the government as a big brother to do things. It's been a change in the concept of government from the policeman to a big brother. Now that has been sparked by the intellectual community in general. Teacher, by writer, by literary people, all of them. And if there's to be a change, I believe it's going to be a change in that philosophy. And I believe there are signs that a change is coming in that philosophy. But I don't believe you'll get anywhere by looking for the influence of the Council on Foreign Relations or the Trilateral Commission or any of these other organizations. I think we have time for just about one or two more questions. Let's make this the next to the last question.
Dr. Friedman, in last year's presidential campaign, a great deal of discussion was lent to the repeal of Section 14B of the Tariff Act. Could you give us some indication of your view on that, in particular to the restriction of freedom of individual workers?
Well, that's, the problem of right to work, which is what's involved, is a very difficult and complicated problem to discuss, but it's very relevant to the subject tonight. And I'm glad you raised it. In principle, I am not in favor of laws either requiring workers to join a union or preventing workers from having a closed shop. It's a very interesting thing that on a level of principle, you can no more justify a right to work law than you can justify a yellow draw, the law against yellow dog contracts. Both of them are wrong. The Fair Employment Practices Act, in my opinion, are wrong because they interfere with freedom of contract. People should be free to contract as they will. The right to work laws are in principle wrong because they are in interference with freedom of employers to contract with a closed shop. And yet, on the other hand, as a practical matter, 14B prevents the imposition of a closed shop by governmental measures. What you've got is a situation here in which you have two wrong things, and you've got to choose among the lesser of the evil. The repeal of 14B would make it impossible for states to get out from under governmental regulations, federal government regulations, which in effect have the effect, even though this isn't legally their word, they have the effect of mandating closed shops, even where both employers and workers might not want it. And 14B provides a loophole whereby the individual states can get out from under that requirement. And as a result, what I'm really in favor of is not the repeal of 14B, but a much more far-reaching change in federal labor legislation, which instead of having the federal labor legislation be as one-sided pro-unionism, make federal legislation much more neutral than it now is. And under those circumstances, I would not support right to work. Under the present circumstances, I'm in a dilemma. I don't like to support it because they seem to be wrong in principle. and yet they offset another evil, and on the whole, the right to work law seem to be the lesser evil of the two. So I think you've raised a very difficult position. Let's take the last question, and then we'll let everybody go home.
Dr. Friedman, I'd like to give your answer to a very simple question that's often very persuasive, and that's that the existence of big business requires the existence of
business. That big government produces big business in part, rather than the other way around. There is nothing about the existence. First of all, what do we mean by big business? Businesses have gotten larger in absolute sums. An individual business on the average employs a much larger number of people than it did in an earlier sense. But in the main, business has not gotten bigger in terms of the share of the market occupied by a small number of enterprises. The great developments in the past 100 years have been improvements in communication and transportation which enable competition to operate over a much wider area. 100 years ago, you had much more local monopoly. The small enterprise was much bigger compared to the local market than the big enterprise can be compared to the foreign market. Now, what's the problem with big business? There's no problem with big business. There's only a problem with monopoly. The problem is to try to avoid a situation in which you have only one potential employer or one potential seller of a product. What would be the most effective way of doing it? The most effective way of doing that is to have complete free trade, to have competition from all over the world. That would almost assure that no company could be in a monopoly position. Under those circumstances, what do you need big government for? Moreover, if you look at the way in which government has become big, it hasn't become big that way. Look at the federal government. What's made it big? What's the department in the federal government today that spends the most money? Health, education, and welfare. The big growth has not been in anything whatsoever having to do with big business. It's been in taking money from some people and giving it to others. It's been in the transfer payments, Social Security, welfare programs, food stamps, all of the rest of it. Not in anything having to do with big business. So I think the argument that big business requires big government is a bunch of nonsense. It just is not in accordance with the facts. That if I subtracted from government those activities which have nothing to do with big business, I would be left with a very small government. Now, people ask a very different question than related to what you say, and that's what I want to answer briefly, and then we'll put that terminate it. People say, well, what difference does it make whether it's General Motors you're dealing with or the U.S. government you're dealing with? Those aren't big enterprises, bureaucratic enterprises, and aren't you just as badly off? There's an absolutely fundamental difference. General Motors cannot get a dollar from you unless you're willing to pay more. It cannot send a policeman to take a dollar out of your pocket. The U.S. government can. That's a fundamental difference. And as a result, I don't believe big business is a kind of threat for big government. Thank you very much.
Don Lipson insisted I put a commercial in and indicated if anybody wants any of those ties that Milton was wearing that he thinks he can arrange for it. I forgot a couple things. I was reminded about the title. Milton and Rose had an occasion to meet with Norman Lear about, six, 8 months ago. And following that, the title that Milton really secretly thinks ought to be applied to the series, you guessed it, Milton Friedman, Milton Friedman. And Harcourt Brace Yovanovitch, incidentally, is going to publish a book that will parallel the television series. And you also really love to hear the one piece of advice that John Kenneth Galbraith gave to Milton. He visited him in Vermont this past summer, and Milton used the occasion to ask him about, well, you did a TV series, and I'm doing one. What's your best, what advice would you provide? And John Kenneth said, well, make sure the royalties on the book are as high as you can make them. That was the only bit of advice he offered. Thank you. Yes.
surroundings and so on.
No, but I'm coming.
When you come, what do you have any idea?
Well, I was there yesterday, saw Leo, hope to get to, may even come next week for the Chaos Club.
Oh, good, that's a
plan. I'm not sure, but in any case, sometime in the next 3 weeks, I will call and we will get together, because I really want to do it.
I've just been elected to the President of the Society. Yeah, I can't really have good by the way, did Britain ever like my proposed title, The Invisible Hand?
Yes. And in fact, it's one of the ones that's in the convention. It's still to be sorted out. I don't know where it's going to go.
Well, I think you end up having a title when you have the series finished.
I think that's
because, it's hard to give a title until you know what
you're doing. That's right. Exactly. Except it's frustrating because we've got to start some promotion. You can't do certain things.